¿Hay preguntas, comentarios?
Sí, sobre lo de el tema de la empatía para definir a los seres humanos que emplea en la novela que has comentado. Quería preguntarte sobre si tiene relación con... Me ha recordado mucho a Sueñan los androides con ovejas eléctricas, no sé si lo has leído, de Philip K. Dick, en el que hay una raza de esclavos que son los androides creados por los humanos y lo que les dice, son exactamente iguales a los humanos, excepto que carecen de empatía y solo se puede distinguir mediante un test de empatía que demuestra que no tienen respuestas empáticas ante... Si está dentro de esa línea o es un poco todo lo contrario. Porque he querido entender un poco que era ese mismo tipo de... Sí.
I agree with you. I think it's actually very similar. In Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, some of the androids, at least one is actually more human than the human hero, anti-hero of the novel. I think that in many ways, with Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and the works that I talked about by Octavia Butler, Philip K. Dick and Octavia Butler do have a lot in common. So I am in agreement with you.
Sí. Y sobre todo la idea de la esclavitud y el considerar que el esclavo es alguien que ni siquiera tiene sentimientos. Es también el concepto dividiendo el ser humano y el esclavo que no lo puedes hacer sufrir porque realmente él no tiene sentimientos. Y bueno, y luego quería comentar sobre Dune y lo del duque y lo que has estado comentando, que ha sido muy interesante tu charla y daría para hablar un montón de cosas. Pero solo un comentario sobre Dune, y es que creo que lo que Herbert, que esto creo que además era muy sorprendente en ese momento para los americanos, quería decir era el usar la religión como un arma política. En ningún momento se plantea que exista Dios o no exista en el universo de Dune, simplemente que la religión es un arma poderosa para ser usada como arma política. La novela creo que fue escrita muchos años antes de lo que pasó en Irán, de lo de Ayatollah Khomeini, pero prácticamente describe lo mismo, es decir, hay un emperador, hay una potencia extranjera que utiliza al país para obtener algo que es muy valioso, que es el petróleo, y hay un líder religioso que sin nada más que... O sea, no teniendo ningún medio, ningún sistema tecnológico, ni teniendo de su parte nada excepto la religión, es capaz de levantar al país contra esto. Cuento una historia muy parecida, parece que está inspirado, pero es anterior de una... Imagino que es algo que ha sucedido muchas veces en la historia.
Frank Herbert actually worked a number of years in Pakistan as a water engineer, ecological engineer. And I think a lot of his influences about Islamic history obviously come from two different sources. One of them is his work within Muslim countries and his awareness of the relationship between desert, water, etc., professionally, but also I think his own kind of experience of the American Southwest. A lot of the actual rituals of the Freeman are actually from the Apaches, taken from the Apache and re-described. I think, in a sense, I would say to you that what he's actually describing is not so much the history of Iran, because of that. He's actually describing a trope about the history of Islam, which is constantly recycled. So whenever we see Islamic phenomena, we end up using those devices to see it, in a way. So it conforms to that pattern. That's why maybe 30 years from now, if things haven't changed, I don't know if you or I will be sitting here, but someone else will be sitting here, and we will be making the same kind of observations, because at the heart of that reading, and that reading is, you know, goes back for a long time, is the kind of notion that only the West has history as a development, and there are rest is cycles. And the thing with cycles is that once you've known, seen one cycle, you've seen them all. So if you're at the right moment, you can make those kind of analogies. And I think what is interesting now, unless of course you believe that he took so much LSD that he actually saw the events of the 1980s and things like that, I think what is interesting is that his reading and his knowledge about Islam came from these tropes. As a result, he is able to make that the foundational plot line of his Dune, which means that every 10, 20 years, we can say quite easily that this is about X, Y, Z. Just before coming to the talk, I was on the internet, someone was saying, written it something like, well, obviously the Emperor Saddam is Saddam, and Arrakis is Iraq. Now, again, this is in 1965, the book was written, so I don't know. So you can make those kinds of jumps there. What is constant is the idea of Islam as not having a history. And therefore, once you detect that cycle, you know where you're coming from, and then you can, it can be applied very very widely.
Yes. I think I want to speak in English. I enjoyed both of the talks very much. Thank you. But I want to talk about the second, about Salman's, and I enjoyed it because I really disagreed, you know, with every single point.
That's the best
point. So it was kind of fun. And you know, I think you've been describing really the mainstream opinion, and you know, judging science fiction, this, you know, sort of popular science fiction maybe you're mentioning, but of course I think, you know, as Catherine has showed, there's other kinds of science fiction which, you know, can be very political and very critical, and you know, for example, like you said, you know, about the institutions, I think, you know, every person or many people are conscious that institutions, you know, since Foucault and since ever, that institutions have been built, and we have to fight, you know, for some things, like for example autonomy in the university. Right now, you know, it's a big fight all over the world, and that's, or sorry, all over, you know, the Western world. I don't know so much about other places, but for example in Mexico, I don't know if you consider that, you know, the West, but that's being also a huge struggle for autonomy. You know, many of my friends were in prison for a year. And so I think this view is very sort of simple somehow, you know. For example, I would say, you know, a fiction where you can see a little bit of this, you know, West with, and they're not the West and the rest, as you were asking for, William Gibson's fiction or J.G. Ballard's are kinds of fictions that really, you know, question many things. Maybe they could go beyond. And of course, you know, I think Octavia Butler is, you know, an author, as you know, Catherine has explained, that you can't really put in that, you know, basket like this. No, that's you know, some of my differences. Thank you.
Okay. Well, two responses. Firstly, I would agree with you that I tended to confine my comments to popular science fiction, and I leave open the possibility. It's a very big world, and lots of people write lots of different things. Having said that, I would say to you that as a genre, it is actually quite remarkable to me that, with a few notable exceptions, where science fiction really fits into tends to be within Europe and the United States, or if you're North America, as a, you know, maybe some parts of Latin America, etc. But it becomes slightly, it becomes magic realism, I guess, I suppose, when it goes down south, which is interesting in itself. So one thing is about drawing the boundaries of what we actually mean by science fiction. And the key here is this, that we can have speculative fiction about imagining different histories, alternative histories, and things like that. But the role of science as a determining factor in that, I think, is kind of interesting. Also, even though, I mean, Octavia Butler and others are writing, you could argue, critically, and I'm not saying all science fiction is a basically a polemicist for the Pentagon. That wasn't my idea, though you could argue that perhaps Star Trek tends to be that sometimes. But anyway, that what I was trying to suggest to you is that even if they are writing critically, and there are many ways of writing critically, they are still caught up in that dichotomy between the West and the rest. The reason why slavery is such a big issue, in a way, is simply because we haven't been able to resolve that in a sense that it hasn't become part of the past. It's still there, and it has to be constantly talked about. The reason why slavery is talked about in the way, especially in American science fiction, or even so-called race relations in popular American science fiction again, because it would have been uncomfortable to talk about it, or practically impossible to talk about it without that distancing of space and time. I don't know if you are aware, or you probably are, that when on Star Trek, the first interracial kiss takes place between Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura. Now, they can only allow to kiss each other because it's 500 years in the future, and Kirk is overtaken by an alien life form. So it's not real, he doesn't mean it, he's got his fingers crossed. And even then, it was banned, and certain stations refused to actually play it and things like that. So in a way, my problem, I'm not arguing that science fiction is always, it is part of the branch of Pravda or something like that, you know, or something like that. It can't be critical, but even the way it's critical is caught up in that kind of dichotomy. And I think that is what I'm trying to say to you is the central feature of what I'm trying to describe, that it can't escape from that distinction between the West and the rest. It's constantly haunted by it. Now, that doesn't mean that people can't put different inflections on it and they can't take different sides on it. But the capacity to actually escape beyond that would require an act of imagination which I haven't, in my limited sort of way, haven't come across. And I would also suggest that act of imagination would probably be restricted to a rather small circle for other reasons.
Actually, I'd like to comment.
Sure.
I agree with you in great part, but I also disagree with you somewhat. I think that some African-American science fiction is successful in blurring the boundary, muddying it, at least, between the West and the rest. I don't know if you're familiar with a 1931 novel by the name of Black No More by George Schuyler. And in this novel, which is a satire, a black scientist invents, an African-American scientist invents a machine that turns black people white. This book was published in 1931, and it is set in the near future. It's set in 1933. Keep in mind that in the 1930s in the United States, segregation was de jure and de facto, and this is pre-World War II. This was a period in which eugenics was embraced as a legitimate science. Many people believed that race was a biological phenomenon, and that black people and white people were biologically different from each other. So in this novel, Schuyler underscores the fact that, well, all the black people turn white, and all of a sudden, like the U.S. economy goes to hell, and society is turned upside down. The white supremacists no longer have, they don't know who to lynch. They don't know who to discriminate against, and so on. And it's actually quite comical. It's a great read. But what Schuyler, the author, is underscoring is that black people are white people, and white people are black people. The novel stresses the fact that there's a long history of miscegenation in the United States, and that race is actually is a social construct, a social fabrication, which, you know, in the 1930s was a radical idea to some. I think that in Kindred, Octavia Butler is doing something very similar. She's showing that this black woman, you know, who's living in Los Angeles in the 1970s, is the descendant of this racist white plantation owner who raped his slaves and bore descendants who were mixed race. That in many ways is American history. I also find it interesting, though, that Butler has been adamant about classifying Kindred as fantasy, not science fiction. So,
just to come back with that. Again, all I wanted to say is this: that as long as we talk about the West and the rest, and it's curious that throughout this presentation I've had to use the word rest to describe the residualness, I think we are still involved in that hierarchy. And while I take absolutely, I have no distinction, I have no complaint about Octavia Butler, and many people who I would suggest to you are actually working on the post-colonial, which is at least blurring of the boundaries. There's one thing to blur the boundaries and to suggest that there is a confusion. It's not necessarily the same as eroding the boundaries and going beyond the boundaries. And I would say, at the best, we are at the blurring of the boundaries, in which it's not very clear where those what the distinctions are. But those distinctions remain in force sufficiently for us not to be able to give names to others except as a residual category.
Westerners. I agree with you, and I also think that the very notion of boundary relies upon duality, you know, a binary. So I agree with you.
It's a funny thing. I haven't seen the miniseries yet of Dune, but as I recall the equivalent scene in the book, Paul does embrace his identity as Mod Deeb. And the saying, when he says, "I'm not your Medi, I'm your Duke," has a very strange echo of something from a very strange place, which was the scene in Reds where... Sorry? Okay, I was just reminded by that description of that scene, which, as I think you say, is only in the TV series, not in Herbert's book. But it reminds me of the scene in Reds, the film about John Reed, the author of 10 Days That Shook the World, who was at the Baku Congress of the Peoples of the East. And he thinks he is preaching revolution, and the translator is preaching jihad. And he is horrified when he finds out what's going on. I think I would agree with you that SF as a genre is, you know, I wouldn't say inherently anti-political, but has a strong bias to the anti-political because of the, I think because of the occupational and other preoccupations of its authors and many of its readers. The sort of hard science engineering mentality tends to see all problems as not political problems, or all problems as ones that can be solved by engineering methods, and even if it's called social engineering, which precisely is not politics. But I think it is unjust to load SF with the colonial, with, you know, this burden of supporting the colonial order, because if you're merely saying that it takes it for granted, then so does all Western popular literature. I mean, you can say that not, in fact, mainstream high serious literature as well as, you know, genre literature does take it largely for granted. I think the places where you have to bear down on it is where it is attempting to deal with categories like imperialism and colonialism, and usually dismally failing or unconsciously or otherwise replicating the kind of taking for granted, as you say, the colonial order. But if you could take a moment to sort of develop a few ideas that your talk suggested to me. One is that when you talk about the West seeing the rest as having not a history but cycles, I think that the Greeks, say, who we claim now for the West as our ancestors, our cultural ancestors, saw themselves and everybody else as being in cycles. In Aristotle's Politics, all political, all states go through cycles, going from anarchy through despotism and democracy and tyranny and so on. And it was in fact only with the so-called discovery of the New World, with 1492, and with the emergence of this distinction, really, that the West began to get an idea of itself as having progress. I think, in fact, it was not immediate either. We can look back and see what looks like progress, but the West was only self-consciously aware of itself as progressing, and the rest of the world is not progressing by about the 18th century, I think. Now, when you say that science fiction has been confined to the West, I don't think that's true, because in China in the 20s, for example, science fiction was taken up very avidly with the people associated science fiction with science, industry, modernization, and so on. And that came to an end, obviously, with the first the totalitarian regime and the civil war of the 30s, and then the communist regime, which didn't have much place for science fiction. But it's very interesting that now, in both Taiwan and the PRC, People's Republic of China, science fiction is very popular indeed, and that's, you know, its own science fiction as well as translations of you know, English and American SF. And in fact, it gets pirated very rapidly. I think you see a similar phenomenon in Japan, and I'll bet that in other countries as well you will see that. I think that, you know, in a way, this whole discourse of post-colonialism reflects a lack of confidence in anti-imperialism. That once peoples did actually get the guns and get the industry and get the technology that the West had initially developed and started developing it for themselves and used it to fight for their emancipation, then these distinctions did begin to break down. That's all. Okay.
Well, a couple of things. I mean, I'm not necessarily here to try and bury science fiction. I actually quite like science fiction. So if I'm making remarks which are considered to be critical or antagonistic to the science fiction, then it's partly to keep everyone awake, I suppose. But more seriously, the problem what we have here, and I think this is where one of the very kind of constant themes in science fiction, or one of the kind of usual tropes, is very interesting, the one of time travel. That every time you actually travel in time, you risk changing time. And of course, you can never get back. And there's a whole kind of possibility that if you specifically want to change time in a particular way, there's a whole paradox that if you go back in time to do that act, do you not transform yourself? And anyway, the multiple, and you know, it's a paradox that cannot be resolved. Similarly, I think what we are dealing with when we're talking about these issues is we have two limits. One is our language itself begins, strains to talk about these things. And the reason is partly to do with the fact that, for example, when you were talking about things like the West, and then you mentioned China, and you mentioned Japan, and you made a distinction between them. And it seemed to be quite axiomatic and quite clear-cut that there was a distinction between them, and we could talk about it. If we actually look at the construction of these entities as being the subjects of, for want of a better word, political forces, then, and something much more mobile and much more fluid, it becomes much more difficult to talk about Japan. Where does Japan now sit in relationship to the West? Where does China sit in relationship to the West? This is the point, yeah. But the point that I'm trying to say is that, in a sense, I don't think of the West as a geographical category. It's more of a project, and in a sense, you know, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have certain kernel or certain kinds of regularities, but really it's the name that is retrospectively that constructs itself. And there are certain features. For example, it's very difficult for me, and perhaps other people can, imagine the West, which is not, if you make a distinction between tradition and modernity, the West will always be on the side of modernity. It's very difficult to imagine the West as being non-modern in a way, even non-industrial in relation to everything else. So there are certain ways of talking about it which reproduce that history. In question of the cyclical history, what is interesting, of course, is the eschatology actually comes from the kind of mainly the real Christian retelling of history, which, of course, history comes to an end with the second coming. So in that sense, that breaks those previous modes. But I'm not trying to, again, condemn science fiction as a exercise in, you know, you use the term about supporting colonialism, and you said, well, other literature did that. Well, I'm not sure it supported it like some sort of, in terms of, you know, holding it up like Atlas-like. Nor do I think can you reduce all literature or all artistic expression to simply that purpose. However, I don't think you can also do the other thing, which is completely disarticulate it and disentangle it and simply say, well, when we do literature or art, we make aesthetic judgments. When we do politics, we make political judgments. I think those judgments, in a sense, become very confined. And the real issue for us, and if you don't want to, if you want to take what I'm talking about, the colonial order, seriously, it isn't so much that colonialism existed out there way back. In a sense, the colonialism or the colonial order only exists to the extent that it exists within us, that it is able to transform us into thinking within those terms so that we can't think any other ways. And this, in a way, what I'm trying to get at. If our language itself is simply an instrument of power, and I'm making this argument very, very simply, but I could make it more subtle, if you like, then the difficulty we have, we can't use power to speak to truth, which is always the idea that you can take the truth and you can take power and you can always use truth as a critique of power. If our very notions of truth and power and are already implicated in relations of power, then I think we have great difficulty being able to disentangle them. And that is the real trick to do. And that's why I think at the most we can get is a kind of a blaring and an awareness. Now, for me, in that sense, the exercise of power becomes very deeply rooted. It's not simply the thing that you do when someone puts a gun to your head and forces you to do it or threatens you with violence. It's the thing that you do that even when you're doing it, you don't know that you're doing what you're doing is carrying out the exercise of power. And that's when it becomes invisible, that it becomes difficult. And I think that's what I'm trying to scratch at. And I can only scratch at it because it's by definition, it escapes that easy assertion.
Bueno, en primer lugar, felicitaros ambos por la conferencia y sobre todo está claro que ha creado polémica, por lo tanto es interesante, ¿no? Bien, es difícil, me gustaría, he creado en mí una serie de... Sería para hablar mucho tiempo sobre todo lo que ha dicho. En parte comparto la opinión que acaba de expresar el señor Ken, pero también estoy de acuerdo con usted que el lenguaje es lo que modifica el pensamiento. Es decir, nosotros somos lo que realmente hablamos. No pensamos lo que decimos, no hablamos según pensamos, sino a la inversa. Entonces, me gustaría reunir todas las cosas. Yo también discrepo de que la ciencia o el sentido de la ciencia pueda ser, o de la ciencia ficción pueda ser antipolítico. Estoy de acuerdo en que tenemos una visión Occidente, de Oriente. Me imagino que usted ha leído al gran ensayista palestino Edward Said, recientemente fallecido, donde en su libro Orientalismo evidentemente explica esto muy claramente, ¿no? Entonces, pero también creo que cargar con la culpa de toda una colonización, o sea, Occidente, evidentemente, la ciencia ficción es occidental en parte porque creo que Occidente utilizó la ciencia como un mecanismo de lucha con la religión a partir del siglo XVII. Entonces, mientras que en otras civilizaciones, en otras culturas, perdón, no quiero hablar de civilización, en otras culturas, ese desfase ha sido más lento, o esa contradicción ha sido más lenta, en Occidente seguimos todavía. Y estoy empleando Occidente no como un lugar al oeste, sino como una mentalidad, como un conjunto de mentalidad. Entrando eso, entroncando con Dune, yo en parte a Dune siempre lo vi como cuando lo escribió Herbert en el 65, como una premonición o una previsión del conflicto palestino, en cierto sentido, ¿no? Evidentemente, él se basa mucho en los conocimientos que tiene del Islam, sobre todo del chiismo, porque habla, en cierto sentido, el Mahdi es el imán perdido que tiene que llegar y restaurar el imperio. De hecho, termina con una yihad intergaláctica, ¿no? Más o menos. Se va a expandir por una yihad perenne. Y no creo que fuera premonitorio, no creo que supiera hablar, pero de hecho se podría ampliar a la primera y segunda intifada. Evidentemente no creo que viera el futuro, ¿no? Está claro que la especia es el petróleo, que el barón Harkonnen podría ser un cierto imperialismo, podríamos llamar, tanto israelí como Estados Unidos, en cierto sentido. En cierto sentido, Dune toca un tema que ahora se está luchando, o que va a ser la futura guerra de Oriente Medio, que es el problema del agua. Y una forma que plantea de destruir Dune precisamente es convertirlo en un planeta húmedo, ¿no? Con las trampas de agua. Entonces creo que es una novela en la que se podrían sacar muchas especulaciones de tipo político o de tipo social. Quería también enlazarlo con la conferencia de Miss Catherine, en el sentido de que los esclavos, o cuando ella hace, no sé si se fue ella o ha hecho usted, el que hace referencia a Alejandro Magno, cuando él se orientaliza y se convierte en persa, pero Alejandro lo hace desde un punto de vista político, él quiere unificar el mundo. Entonces hoy lo meteríamos en la cárcel porque lo que hace es trasladar poblaciones a la fuerza. O sea, lleva persas a Grecia y lleva griegos a Persia, ¿no? Lo que hace es mezclar las poblaciones porque necesita es una unificación. Y también desde un punto de vista convencido, pero sobre todo desde un vista político, desde un punto de vista práctico. ¿Cómo la ciencia ficción puede ser popular o puede ser no apolítica? Yo creo que la ciencia ficción, igual que toda la literatura, va en función de quien la escriba, está en un lugar del momento y de las influencias políticas. Hay una ciencia ficción especulativa, bastante política y bastante irreverente, ¿no? Y hay una ciencia ficción propagandística. Evidentemente, yo a Terminator no lo consideraría como una ciencia ficción, simplemente como una propaganda, evidentemente, de un Estado norteamericano actual y muy concreto. Pero, por ejemplo, de un autor norteamericano, como es la trilogía de Marte, de Stanley Robinson, sin embargo, hay bastante especulación desde el punto de vista política, económica, social, etcétera, etcétera. O sea, que yo creo que todo depende del momento, de la persona y, sobre todo, de la entidad política, ¿no? Gracias.
Sí, bueno, solo quería comentar una...
¿Se oye?
Sí. Una cosa sobre lo que comentabas de Occidente y Oriente. Yo creo que el tema principal quizá no es la ciencia ficción, es más bien el tema de la ciencia y de interpretar el mundo desde un punto de vista científico. Porque relatos fantásticos han existido en todas las culturas y eso, el tema que nos lo diferencia de todo esto creo que es el tema científico, que es un poco la religión de Occidente, la... Quiero decir que la ciencia que tenemos empieza con los griegos, pero sobre todo no se pierde y es difundida y gracias a los musulmanes. Fueron ellos los que la mantuvieron durante gran parte de lo que fue la Edad Media, los que lograron grandes avances. Y es la misma ciencia que estamos usando ahora. Es decir, simplemente hay un momento en el que parece que hay una división y es el mundo cristiano el que sigue adelante con ese proyecto, mientras que el mundo musulmán, que fue el que lo... Cuando el mundo cristiano se había olvidado de él, el que lo mantuvo con vida, se queda atrás. Y ese momento también un poco coincide con estos 500 años de los que tú estás hablando. No sé, creo que quizá la misma división está entre Occidente y Oriente. Yo creo que es... más bien una forma de interpretar el mundo que ha vencido a partir de ese momento y que podría haber vencido en cualquier sociedad distinta. Eso.
Para completar eso, yo creo que también tiene que ver mucho con las ponencias de ayer, ¿no? La diferencia de culturas hace que se tomen caminos diferentes. Eso yo creo que está siempre presente, ¿no? El choque de culturas y cuál de ellas sale vencedoras es lo que determina el futuro.
Y además hay un extra, no sé cómo explicarlo bien. Ahora estamos en un camino en el cual el mundo se está globalizando y además en el cual la ciencia va avanzando en un sentido que puede que no guste mucho en el mundo occidental. Me explico. Con la globalización todas las culturas se están homogeneizando, queramos o no queramos. Y los avances científicos que se están haciendo, los descubrimientos, no los avances técnicos, sino los descubrimientos más biológicos y eso, que están haciendo que descubramos que todos los seres humanos somos en realidad muy, muy, muy parecidos. Los derechos humanos están asegurando, están intentando asegurar eso, por otro lado, de forma legal y demás. Nos vamos a encontrar con que la situación que nos vamos a encontrar va a ser que no va a haber el otro, no va a haber ese oriente, no va a haber ese. Y la sociedad, vamos, quizá peque de ignorante, pero yo siempre he visto que Roma colapsó cuando se quedó sin esclavos, que los imperios, cuando no tienen más que expansionarse, no pueden explotar al otro, no pueden tener un recurso extra por fuera, colapsan. Y no sé si vamos precisamente en ese sentido al homogeneizar todo lo que tenemos, porque no tenemos otro al cual echarle mano. No sé si me estoy explicando.
Very briefly, a lot of very interesting comments, and I couldn't do justice to all of them. But just to sketch out, I think one thing we would like to believe is that something we always believed, that especially after the Holocaust, this would never happen again. And because one of the things that we thought was that the idea that human beings could divide some as being non-human and others as being human was something that Auschwitz put an end to that. And this is something that a conceit that we carried around our heads for a very long time. But I think what's been demonstrated first in Bosnia and now subsequently, that in the end, that's a very fragile notion that we have. And it's very easy to transform one who we consider to be human and who we consider to be non-human. And this is what that point I was trying to make between friend and enemy. Our enemy is basically someone who is our equal. A demon is not our equal. A virus is not our equal. And there are different ways of describing conflict. And what is startling in the contemporary period now is that the way that we describe the conflict is in terms of the otherness of the other, rather than in terms of the otherness of interests. This is very curious. If you listen to George Bush go on, and he will tell you that the war against terrorism is a war against civilization, against barbarism, it's a war about existential choice, et cetera, evil, and war against evil. Now, if you look at the statements that come from Al-Qaeda, they will tell you that what they want is American troops out of Saudi Arabia, or the Israelis to stop occupying Palestine, or American troops out of Iraq, or whatever. So in a sense, we have the fundamentalists are talking a language of public policy, and the anti-fundamentalists are talking a language of almost theological limits, that there is, you know, these are abstract kind of categories. And I find that very, very curious, that who is actually being a fundamentalist here, because whether you agree with these public policy choices or not, it's another matter, but they are something that you can consider and discuss and whatever. But if you're saying that we are having a conflict against evil and barbarism, well, how can you have a discussion with evil? How can you have a any kind of engagement? And the point that I'm trying to make here is that this is the thing about the fragile. That in a sense, if you look again to something like Starship Troopers, and a very interesting, a beautiful fascist film. I mean, it's incredible. One of the best portrayals of fascism, I think, around. But here we have these spider-like creatures who, does anyone actually know why they're being destroyed? Did we ever ask when you're watching that film? I mean, I'm just happy that the bugs got squashed. I never bothered wondering, well, actually, what is it about them? And the only thing we're ever told, they're afraid of us, and that was enough. So in a sense, what I'm trying to say here is that we should be perhaps cautious about our capacity to recognize humans as humans, like it's axiomatic. Too many times, too often, we've forgotten that. And we've forgotten that in a particular phase of history. And this is why I think, again, go back to the colonial order. Colonial order is very, very extraordinary. They were enemies before. There have been many, many enemies, but it never reached the limits that there were enemies who were, we considered to be simply, like I said, demons or viruses that had no, absolutely no human dignity. They didn't go to sleep at night. They don't. This, again, the phenomenon of the suicide bomber. Again, I find it very interesting that we find that killing someone with a helicopter gunship is somehow not worthy of comment, but when you kill someone by killing yourself, that is somehow more terrifying. And we talk about a culture of death that does it, rather than a culture of desperation that produces that sacrifice. So all I want to say is this, that while I don't want to lay everything on science fiction's door, that I think it's there, in the sense science fiction is part of a particular cultural formation in which science became, and I think I agree with you, that science became to occupy, in this particular civilization, the place of religion in some sense, however you want to put it. And that's how it sees itself, or presented itself as an answer. And the fiction on that, if you think about science fiction writers, and one way of thinking of them, are basically as high priests trying to interpret the will, what this god of science actually wants and can do and what not do. I mean, in a sense, it's a kind of hermeneutic role that a science fiction has. Now, of course, it has more than that. And you will find dissident priests and people who will, you know, all over, if you want, science fiction writers who don't agree with the canonized version and things like that. But the thing that strikes me, and the reason why I maintain the question of the anti-political nature, is that science, by its definition, wants to be able to, and I think you made the point about science and technology, in a way, leads to technology which reduces the possibility of anything, all problems being ultimately kinds of engineering that you can kind of resolve. Now, that, I think, is the key kind of moment that I'm trying to say now. You may disagree with me and say, well, no, it's much more complex than that, and I'm sure it always is more complex than that. But I still think there's enough element of what I'm saying which has certain kind of resonance to make it not completely invalid, at least worth thinking about.
Eres primero.
Sí, bueno, voy a intentar ser muy breve, ¿no? No lo pretendía, pero dada la circunstancia. Bien, con relación a Catherine, el concepto de lo humano, bueno, en relación a todo lo que estamos comentando, desde mi punto de vista, ¿no? Creo que lo humano hay que calificarlo tanto en sentido positivo como negativo. Es decir, hasta el asesino es humano, o el violador, o el dictador. Lo que sí creo que habría que utilizar categorías en donde se busque elementos emancipadores o liberadores sobre qué se entiende como un proceso de humanización que genera humanidad desde la pluralidad, la complejidad, relacionalidad, multiculturalidad o interculturalidad, etcétera, etcétera. Y evidentemente buscar categorías que denuncien esos diferentes procesos de dominación, exclusión, marginación, etcétera, etcétera. Eso por un lado. Por otro lado, creo que en la discusión que se está entablando, tan interesante, creo que hay un punto en común en todos, ¿no? Y estoy muy de acuerdo con Sayid en el sentido de que muchas veces hay que ver los distintos niveles en donde nos movemos y los distintos procesos de significación y lo malo político, la política, reducido, restringido, pues evidentemente ya estamos condicionados. Si resignificamos el sentido de lo político, pues evidentemente con las tres variables que nos has dado, pues se puede ver la ciencia ficción con esa riqueza que los demás compañeros y compañeras nos han ido diciendo, ¿no? Entonces, a un nivel concreto del poder, porque el poder tiene muchas caras, yo sí estoy de acuerdo en que se da una versión colonizadora de lo que es no solo la ciencia ficción, sino lo que implica la cultura occidental. Ahora, lo que también creo que estamos de acuerdo es que en el seno de la propia cultura occidental hay muchas tradiciones y muchos procesos de lucha distintos. Y fuera de la cultura occidental, la cultura islámica, budista, indígena, waorani, shuar, etcétera, etcétera, ¿no? Entonces, creo que es importante reivindicar esos distintos procesos donde se cuestiona evidentemente, los procesos expansionistas o de colonización, ¿no? Y entonces, simplemente ya para terminar, en ese dualismo amigo-enemigo, que creo que es una de las críticas que la propia teoría feminista realiza, ¿no?, como una manera de ver la realidad de forma dualista y en oposición, creo que es importante descubrir ese proceso de quién es amigo y quién es enemigo, pero pregunto si la intención es para que no haya más enemigos o para desplazar, para no absolutizar la contingencia de la historia, desplazar otro tipo de enemigo. ¿Se trataría de hacer desaparecer enemigo o se trataría de...?
I don't think there's one answer to that final question. I think that it can be answered in many ways depending on the situation. For example, going back to your previous comment, I think that right now the U.S. needs an enemy. I think George Bush and his allies need an enemy. I think that 9/11 was the best thing that happened to the right in the United States of America and the rest of the world, and that I don't think that Bush and Rumsfeld et al. Are intent on destroying their enemies. I think that they rely on them very heavily right now. So I think that enemies serve different functions for different people. Depending on the context. I'll keep my comment short just because I know that we're running out of time.
Just very briefly, I actually agree with you. I think life is a mess, and history is even a bigger mess. And one day you wake up and you find your friends are your enemies, and tomorrow you might find vice versa. And for that reason, I think we have to try avoiding this kind of the scenario that the Marquis de Sade used to paint, where eventually, you know, you have this castle where all these victims come for torture, and once all these victims are exhausted, the torturers look upon each other and say, well, who are we going to torture next? And then turn themselves inward. I think that the thing about remembering what an enemy is that we've become very, very loaded. I mean, in a way, having this discussion is only possible because they are enemies, in a sense that we talk about these things, but once we finish that talk, it'll be over. But we have different viewpoints, and we're arguing for them. There's nothing wrong with being an enemy of a particular viewpoint and being a friend of another viewpoint. The problem comes when we start overlapping, that basically, if I disagree with you on this point, I will disagree with you at every single point ever, and that's when I think the danger comes into, when the enemy is actually simply turned into a biological thing. I think we should be open enough to recognize, let us, you know, it's almost a Nietzschean thing. Let us have enemies, because that means we're having strong disagreements, but also that means our friendship is worth something. I don't want to be friends with somebody who's friends with everybody, because at the end of the day, what does their friendship matter? So in a sense that enemy, we all do that in France, so let's not get too worked up about the notion of enemies. I'm not saying you should go out and shoot people you don't agree with, but recognize that sometimes you disagree with people because it's worth having that disagreement.